This past week, I received an invitation to attend a groundbreaking ceremony for yet another facility in our community that is being erected by Harbor Homes. I think it's actually a refurbishing of an already existing building over on Factory Street. It's part of a Veterans First program that will provide housing for military veterans who are experiencing certain mental and emotional challenges that call for a level of assisted care, but are capable of leading largely independent lives. This will be similar to the residential facility and program offered at Buckingham Place. That's the building downtown next to the post office, also operated by Harbor Homes. For the past 25 years now, Harbor Homes has been providing housing services for persons who are dealing with mental or emotional disorders. These are men and women who are not in need of institutionalization, but who need some level of assisted care while living as independently as they are capable of doing. And some of the impetus for bringing this organization into existence did begin here at this church. Lee Page, who wanted to be in the service today, found out over the weekend that a close friend of hers in the Philadelphia area had passed away, so she is on her way there to attend her memorial service today. But it was Lee who saw the need for such a facility in Nashua back when she was a social worker with the community council. She has since become a UU minister herself. Lee took her concerns to my predecessor, the Reverend Donald Riley, and together they got the conversation going in our community about the need for assisted living for persons with developmental disabilities of a mental or emotional nature and who had no place to live. So when I attend this ceremony on the 5th of November, I will not go simply for myself, but I will also consider myself as representing this congregation, given the role that we have played for nearly three decades now since bringing Harbor Homes into existence. Well, this upcoming event also serves as my lead-in to the person from our Unitarian Universalist, and it's Universalist in this case, story, whose life I want to hold up for a time today. It is that of Dr. Benjamin Rush, an 18th century physician who came to be known as the father of American psychiatry, and he was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. Dr. Rush also played an instrumental role in shaping and defining the Universalist Church in America, which is one of the predecessor organizations of our current Unitarian Universalist Association. Dr. Rush is one of those founding patriots who significantly contributed to the creation of our country, but who, as history came to be told, became somewhat overshadowed by other such luminaries as Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Jefferson or the Adamses. In fact, one of the better-known achievements for Dr. Rush is his being the person who helped to reconcile the friendship of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson after the two had become estranged from one another. Back up a little bit, it was about 3 to 4 years ago that I created a sermon tradition for myself by using this last Sunday in October, to tell a story from our Unitarian Universalist heritage and to try to link it up in some ways with things that we are concerned about, thinking about today. The reason I took this date is it was because it is the closest Sunday, last Sunday in October, is the closest Sunday to the date of the martyrdom execution of Michael Servetus on October the 27th, 1553, in Geneva, Switzerland, at the hand of John Calvin. Servetus's crime was to challenge the classical Christian doctrine of the Trinity, something which Mr. Calvin could not countenance. Mr. Servetus had written a book called On the Errors of the Trinity, and then he went and made his own error, his fatal error, by going to Geneva to debate Mr. Calvin on the subject. Mr. John Calvin was not interested in a debate. He was the power behind the civil authorities in Geneva, and he saw to it that Servetus was permanently dispatched by having him burned at the stake with his book on the errors of the Trinity tied to his waist. Whew. So, as I say, I use this Michael Servetus Sunday to hold up and celebrate the life of a figure from our Unitarian Universalist history. Although Servetus was a Unitarian, I'm working, as I said, the Universalist side of the family today. But before I jump into the life of Dr. Rush, I want to spend just a few more minutes on the topic which I opened up with, which has to do with our attitudes towards persons who are dealing with some form of mental illness, however mild or severe, and how their lives affect ours, and how they affect our members of our family. This was the matter that Dr. Rush, in the latter years of the 18th century, was also looking to come to terms with. Last spring, one of our members, Kathy Fletcher, who also gave us our words for reflection this morning about our universalist heritage, Kathy, she told a very moving story about growing up with an autistic younger brother and of her experiences in taking him to church. With Kathy's permission, I'm going to cite some of what she said. I would like to have done the whole sermon again, but I kind of had to pull a few excerpts here. On more than one occasion in a Sunday service, my brother raged, screamed, and cried. And I was the one responsible for leading him out of the service. I felt like everyone in that sanctuary was staring at us and judging us. I felt huge shame. I was also angry. But then she went on, "There are no hardships that do not also offer a blessing. And what are the blessings of growing up in a family with my brother? I'm not afraid of people different from me. I went to a big university. I met a lot of different people. I met black people, gay and lesbian people, people with dyslexia, people my own age with children, people who had been sexually abused. And from growing up with someone I thought so different, I think I learned not to judge. I learned to meet people and talk to them where they are, and that certainly is a blessing." And I thank Kathy for those very fine words and for allowing me to bring them back to you again this morning. Another very powerful and poetic, and in this instance, kind of a gut-wrenching account of how mental illness can have a ripple effect in a family is found in a poem by the late poet Allen Ginsberg. The poem is called Kaddish. Kaddish is a Jewish prayer or meditation for the dead. And Allen wrote the poem in the aftermath of the death of his mother, Naomi Ginsberg, whose death came after a long institutionalization, or a long series of institutionalizations, for her increasingly pronounced paranoid schizophrenia. This illness came on to Naomi when Allen was quite young, and she sank further and further into it until her death. The poem itself, which takes a very long, it's even longer than Howell, takes over an hour to read it. And it chronicles first his mother's life, and then tells of Alan's experiences with her when he was still a teenager and was left to take care of her while his father, Lewis, went off to work. His father was an English teacher, and his older brother was away in school. And young Alan experienced in equal quantities his love for his mother and his increasing sense of helplessness about being able to do anything for her. In one part of this long poem narrative, Allen recalls the beautiful woman of family photographs, the daughter of Russian Jewish emigres who fell in love with and married his father. "Oh, Russian-faced woman on the grass, your long black hair is crowned with flowers. The mandolin is on your knees. You sit here married in the summer among daisies, promised happiness at hand." And then later in the poem, the scene shifts, to a mental hospital where Alan is visiting her as a young man. "Small, broken woman, the ashen indoor eyes of hospitals, ward grayness on skin. Are you a spy? I sit at the sour table, eyes filling with tears. Did Lewis send you?" She beat her head. "I'm not a bad girl. I raised two children. 2 years since I've been there." I started to cry. She stared. "Nurse broke up the meeting a moment. I went into the bathroom to hide against the toilet white walls." You read that poem in its entirety, as I have a few times. I find it hard to get all the way through it without actually weeping in places. For it is about a son striving and struggling to see the humanity in his mother and striving to preserve and proclaim his love for her, even as he sees her overtaken by madness and finds that she is increasingly moving out of his reach. Well, may seem like a bit of a leap to go from Allen Ginsberg to Benjamin Rush, but that's where we're going to go now. For the common thread between Kathy and Allen and Dr. Rush is their striving to touch and uphold the humanity of those who have had some of the more essential pieces of their humanity taken from them. On that note, let's take a look at the story of Dr. Rush. He was born to privilege in the Philadelphia area in 1745. He lost his father when he was only 6 years old, and the primary male figure in his life who kind of took over that role was uncle, who was also a Presbyterian minister. Now, I read about his life, and I figured young Benjamin must have been one of those precocious kids that parents would hold up as an example to other kids, which mean all the other kids wouldn't like him. You know, why can't you be a little more like Benjamin over there? He earned his bachelor's degree at the age of 15 from the College of New Jersey, which later became Princeton University. From there, he went to England, where he got his medical degree at the University of Edinburgh, returned to Philadelphia, opened up a medical practice at the age of 24, and became a professor of chemistry at what is now the University of Pennsylvania, leading me to wonder what he did in his spare time. One thing he did in his spare time was politics. He was a strong supporter of the American Revolution. He collaborated with Thomas Paine in Paine's writing of the pro-independence journal Common Sense. He got himself elected as a Pennsylvania representative to the Continental Congress, and as noted, was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. Well, he had this resume that went on and on to the point that I'm not going to belabor it any further, except to note that he also managed to have quite a family life in the midst of all his other doings. He married a woman named Julia Stockton, who was the daughter of one of the Declaration's signers, and they had 13 kids. Dr. Rush apparently was not one to do a halfway job in anything he undertook. Four of the Rush children died in infancy, and this was not, at that time, an uncommon survival rate, even for families of means and status like the family he was in. But it's his religious and his humanitarian views that I mostly want to shed some light on, and they, as you'll see as I go along, they very much precede, they're kind of the forerunners of what Kathy read a little while ago from Clarence Skinner. Rush, as noted, was raised Presbyterian, largely due to the influence of that minister uncle. He was a devout Christian. He founded the Philadelphia Bible Society. And at some point in his spiritual religious journey, he became convinced of the truth, as he saw it, of universal salvation. The underlying principle of universalism was that the love of God for human beings was paramount, to the point that such a loving God would not condemn any human being to eternal damnation and punishment. There were different schools of thought within universalism at that time, and Rush happened to be of the one called Restorationism, which held that those who had been especially bad sinners on earth had to do a little time in kind of a universalist version of purgatory before they could be restored in the afterlife to full reconciliation with God. His religious beliefs, as was the case with early universalists, did include an afterlife, and his restorationist views were really his way of dealing with that age-old problem of evil and how human beings are held ultimately accountable, if they are, for the bad deeds they do on earth. That school of thought didn't last all that long within universalism, but that was Rush's persuasion. He was a universalist, and when the fledgling universalist churches in eastern United States held a founding convention in Philadelphia in 1790, it was Benjamin Rush to whom they turned to draft their founding document. This document was one of the many forerunners of our current Unitarian Universalist purposes and principles. Just to make a side note observation here, I would say that given his pedigree, Rush would have been well embraced in the more rarefied atmosphere of the Unitarians of Philadelphia and New England than the Universalists. For the Universalists in their origin were much more of a working class, rural-based, kind of farmers working the land type of denomination. That was their demographic. Their adherents to Universalism were by and large very bright people, but by and large also had very limited formal education. And so in being a Universalist, Dr. Rush was really going against type. But even these, but these were the people, the Universalists, were the ones with whom he felt an affinity, even though he was, by and large, from a different class himself. So, as I say, when the Universalists began to get organized, they turned to Dr. Rush to compose their founding document. And when it came to putting forth their doctrine of God, here is what Dr. Rush wrote and what was adopted. "We believe in one God, infinite in all his perfections, and these perfections are all modifications of infinite, adorable, incomprehensible, and unchangeable love." Infinite, adorable, incomprehensible, and unchangeable love. God was the presence of that kind of love. There's not much of a reference to a supreme being here, but the presence of this type of love. Of course, Rush and all the Universalists at that time wanted to keep that, kept their faith within a Christian context. And so they maintained that Jesus was the earthly, sort of time-bound embodiment or incarnation of this infinite love. And Jesus' mission on earth was not to save human beings from a sinful state, but rather to show human beings what the love of God looked like in human form and in human activity. Well, however distant some of us may feel from that theology and Christology, some do not, it was this Universalist idea of a God whose love for human beings is infinite that came to find a much more humanistic expression in our first Unitarian Universalist principle, which says we affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. There is, what I'm saying, a theological root to this humanist affirmation of ours, and Benjamin Rush was one of the primary authors of those theological origins. And for Dr. Rush, they were not just words in a document he was asked to write by a fledgling religious denomination. They were a guiding principle in his life that made him, in addition to everything else, a devoted humanitarian. He was a strong abolitionist. He enlisted many of his fellow Universalists in the anti-slavery movement. He was an opponent of capital punishment in the late 1700s. And when the post of a Secretary of War was created for President Washington's cabinet, which later became the position of Secretary of Defense, it was Dr. Rush who also advocated, unsuccessfully as it turned out, for a post of Secretary of Peace. That is to say, there have been advocates for a Department of Peace for as long as there has been an American presidency, and Benjamin Rush was among the first of them. But his most noted contribution, when it comes to how Dr. Rush applied his Universalist principles, was in the area of the treatment of the mentally ill, and his insistence that mental illness be largely treated as a medical condition. That sounds rather matter of fact to us today, but it went strongly against the grain of his day, where persons who were struggling with a mental illness of any kind were seen as either being demon-possessed or being punished by God for some undisclosed sin, or simply showing a human weakness by an inability or an unwillingness to pull themselves out of the condition they were in on the strength of their own efforts. To be sure, Dr. Rush's treatment methods, as we would judge them now, were crude. Many physical maladies in his day were attributed to bad blood, and the treatment, therefore, was to do bloodletting in the hopes of getting the bad stuff out. Germs and viruses and such things as that were largely undiscovered or were going unrecognized in terms of how they actually affected what was going on in the body. So this line of reasoning went, if mental illness was a medical condition, then the medical model remedy at that time was to get rid of the bad blood that was causing it. All this really did was cause a loss of blood. But Rush, to his credit then, was among the first to propose a medical model for the treatment of the mentally ill, which did in turn pave the way for what we now call the whole field of psychopharmacology. And for Rush, this approach stemmed from his religious conviction that persons dealing with a mental illness were not people to be condemned for a personal weakness or because they had found disfavor with God, but rather human beings whose dignity was to be respected and who were to be treated as humanely as possible. It was this same conviction that led Dr. Rush to push for the establishment of mental hospitals where such treatment could be more focused. Here again, those initial attempts at institutionalization may well seem crude by our contemporary standards, but to even advocate for special facilities for the sole and focused treatment purpose of treating the mentally ill was quite a radical notion in his day. Today, as many of you know, in your personal experience, family member, working in the field, treatment of mental illness combines a medical model and a therapeutic model, which is to say some form of counseling and medication together. And there's an indebtedness to Dr. Rush for demonstrating, as I say, that medical component and dispelling the notion that it can simply be treated or attributed to human weakness or some kind of divine activity. I would also just quickly add that for all the advances that have been made in such treatment, practically any family who has had to deal with even the more mild to the more severe forms of mental illness know what a stress and a strain on the whole family situation, on the whole family system, such a situation can be. And while I support the granting of the most appropriate levels of personal autonomy to persons with mental and emotional maladies, I'm also aware of how the refusal of medication can push those family stresses to even greater levels. This is a most crucial and difficult balance to achieve. How much autonomy, how much self-direction can properly be given to those struggling with a mental illness versus how much intervention can again properly be imposed? This is an ongoing issue, an ongoing struggle, and how everyone feels about it, we still have Benjamin Rush to thank for beginning the process and the treatment of the mentally ill to the point that we can now even have such a conversation. His designation as the father of American psychiatry is well earned. I'm going to pull this together now. This life of one of our universalist forebears I find to be a truly remarkable one. And I especially hold it up as a sterling example of how one's religious convictions inform and direct a person's living a life of service to one's fellow human beings. And to be such a passionate advocate for social justice, for the greater good as well. This was the point that Clarence Skinner was making in the reading Kathy shared earlier. Next Sunday, I'm going to be taking up the topic of whether a rational person could also be a religious person, especially in light of some recent claims made by such men as Christopher Hutchins or Sam Brown or Richard Dawkins, who appear to be united in their opinion that a man or a woman cannot be both and still be an authentic human being. What I see in the life of a man like Benjamin Rush is one of the most highly educated persons of his time and place, and one of the most dedicated humanitarians of his time and place, and one of the most passionate devotees to social justice of his time and place, was also one of the most devoutly religious persons of his time and place. When he reached for what he regarded as the ultimate motivation for how he lived and dedicated his life, he eventually got back to that universalist belief in a God of universal love and caring and compassion. And the message from his life to ours, as I see it, is not that we necessarily embrace his religion, chapter and verse, but that we continue to explore and dig ever more deeper into our own convictions, into what the sources of those convictions are, as we seek the most authentic and loving ways of living our lives as well. This indeed is one of the many reasons as to why we come together in community here, so we may continue to grow a life and to grow a soul that will be a blessing to the other lives that we encounter. With that thought in mind, let's sing together our closing hymn. It's number 345, "With Joy We Claim the Growing Life."